Who said full-bodied, flavoursome, non-alcoholic red wine? The latest innovation from alcohol-free brand Groovy is their new red blend, which has been created in collaboration with the people whose opinion counts the most, their customers. Based on feedback from the first drop, the second iteration of the red blend is available now. Served in a can, this is a dry red blend, which is medium-bodied with notes of jammy raspberries and blackcurrant. And like all other Groovy wines, it contains 0.0% alcohol. You can get your Groovy at www.getgroovy.com. That's Groovy spelled G-R-U-V-I. Or find them in a variety of specialty and liquor stores throughout North America. Use their store finder to discover a stockist near you. You can also use the code SOBERCURIOUS10 to get 10% off your first online order. And if you feel like getting creative, they are always sharing fun mocktail recipes at Get Groovy on Instagram. Welcome to this week's edition of the Sober Curious podcast. I'm your host, Ruby Warrington, and my guest today is Jane Mattingly, who is a therapist and eating disorders recovery coach and the founder of Recovery Love and Care. I've wanted to have a conversation about how eating disorders fit into the landscape of addiction and recovery for a long time, partly because of my personal history with anorexia. It was only while writing Sober Curious that I became fully aware of the extent to which this is absolutely a part of my addiction story. But I'd shied away from talking about it publicly as A, I feel a lot of shame about having been anorexic, and B, I know what a controversial and potentially triggering subject this can be. But then I started to do some more research, and I discovered that 50% of individuals with eating disorders also abuse alcohol or other drugs. This is a rate 5 times higher than the general population, which I think is significant enough that we can't not talk about it. Jane was absolutely the perfect person to bring on to have this conversation. And yes, we go to some pretty controversial places when it comes to subjects like diet culture, fat phobia, and ableism, all of which are swirling in the ethers with this subject. We also talk about the rise of orthorexia, which is an obsession with healthy eating, the role of attachment theory in all of this, and the cornerstones of eating disorder recovery. This is my conversation with Jane Mattingly. Jane, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to have a conversation like this for quite a long time, but it hadn't really felt, I don't know, it sort of really bubbled up recently in my consciousness. It's just something that's been coming much closer to the surface. And so the time feels really right to dig into this. Now, I'm coming from the background of having had an eating disorder myself, but it's so far in my past. And I think this is one of the reasons why I didn't really feel the need to talk about it. Like, it just feels like it happened so long ago that it doesn't bear any relevance to kind of like my subsequent substance abuse, to conversations about substance abuse. And I'm seeing that that's actually not the case at all. Now, I suppose my interest was actually piqued again around this subject when I read The Biology of Desire by Mark Lewis, which is one of the first books I read about the nature of addiction and the nature of the addictive brain. Now, in this book, he profiles 5 addicts who sort of enact their own recovery. They don't necessarily have any specific treatment program. They just, through their own kind of self-work, are able to overcome their addictions. Now, one of the people he profiles has anorexia, which kind of morphs into bulimia at different phases. And the others are a heroin addict, a crystal meth addict, an opioids addict, and an alcoholic. And I remember being really surprised when I read this that he'd included somebody who had an eating disorder, because I had never thought about an eating disorder as an addiction or within the context of addiction. So I actually kind of looked up before we got on the phone. I sort of went to that section and I'm just going to read a couple of the things that he said. And I think that that can kind of like, you know, open up our discussion today. So this is very much what I felt. He says, in one way, anorexia seems the opposite of addiction. We characterize addiction by the loss of self-control, but anorexia epitomizes over-control. He also then goes on to say, yet anorexia and addiction are as similar as twin sisters. Neither anorexics nor drug addicts exercise top-down control when it comes to the behavior that harms them, which I felt was a really interesting piece. Whereas eating disorders to an outsider or to anyone who's experienced, you know, disordered eating, obsessive thinking about food and diet, even can, it seems very connected to control. Whereas when we think about addiction, we think about the end of willpower, we think about overindulgence. You know, there's Overeaters Anonymous, but I've never seen an Anorexics Anonymous, for example. So I suppose that's where I'd like us to dive in. And that's sort of a bit of my own sort of background awareness around this subject. But perhaps to kick off, can you talk about your understanding of eating disorders as addictions? Why are they in the same category?
Yeah, it, my goodness, there's so much here. There's so much here and I have so many thoughts. You know, when I work with my clients, I often talk about how, yes, eating disorders and addictions are very similar and they are so different if you really look at them. And, but we can look at it and how it affects the brain and our behaviors. They're very similar in that way, in that people with eating disorders look like they have and present as if they have emotional resilience. They do not. There's no emotional resilience there the second you take away the eating disorder. The eating disorder, whether that be anorexia, orthorexia, binge eating, bulimia, purging, whatever it might be, is basically a means to preserve. It's a means to regulate your nervous system. It's a means to cope. And it only works temporarily. It does not sustain. And so when we start to take away those disordered and harmful behaviors, we're not able to handle the emotions like we thought we were able to. We're not able to handle the hard stuff. And so the great thing about that is that emotional resilience is learned. We're not born with it. It's learned. And so then when you go through recovery, you build all these tools and you become this incredible human being who has all of this skill and knowledge and tools on how to deal with hard things. But in that aspect, I would say they're very similar in that it has to do with how we cope and numbing of emotions. And then it's also so incredibly different than addictions as well.
That makes a lot of sense. In fact, that was a question I had further down, like just questioning what, to what extent eating disorders are psychological coping mechanisms, methods of dissociation. And that's absolutely something that I can relate to when I think about what I was going through during that period of my life. I just wanted to vacate my body and actually denying myself food was a really effective way to do that. It also gave me something to think about constantly that wasn't all of the things I didn't want to think about. It was very painful and not pleasurable. And again, with addiction, especially when it comes to substance abuse, we think about people looking for a high, seeking pleasure, whereas this almost is the opposite, because it felt like
I was
Well, it felt to me like I was just punishing myself. I was in constant pain, you know, in constant psychological anguish. But that psychological anguish I could control. The other forms of psychological anguish, which I do actually touch on in my book, I'm not going to go into detail about it here, were things I guess I felt I couldn't control.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Oh my gosh. And it's very, I mean, I think it's unique for different diagnoses, for the severity of eating disorders and how it presents for people, because they're so multidimensional. They're not just psychological. They're not just physical. They're not just social. It's not just nutritional. I mean, it's like such an inclusive disorder, I should say. And so there are people that I will talk to, and the research shows that when there is a high that can occur with restriction, and there is absolutely a high that occurs with purging. And then a lot of other people will describe it as like numbing pain, a pain that they can tolerate. And, you know, a means to cope, but there is that high that does happen where our bodies are actually quite resilient in the famine response, because our bodies have been through it so often through evolution. And so they have these chemicals and we have these hormones that prepare us for it. And it actually gives us like a euphoria and to like get through a famine.
Right.
And little does our body know that we're not in a famine. We're actually slowly killing ourselves.
Yeah. Wow. You've just reminded me of something. Actually, I remember after I first moved to New York in 2012, like juice fads were kind of all the rage at that point. And this is, I was about at least 10, 15 years recovered by this point. Yeah. And I remember I did an article for a paper in the UK about doing a juice fast. And I remember on the second day, I felt so high, but I felt almost instantly all of those old behaviors, all of those old kind of triggers from my anorexia were immediately like right back, because not only was I feeling kind of like high and like I was in control and I was kind of just not weighed down and everything was kind of just flowing. There was also this little voice that went, oh, and you're losing weight too. Oh, and you're losing weight too. It's like, as much as I thought that had completely, that I completely moved on from it, it was still so deeply embedded in my psyche, which was really scary to me. And at that point, I never became vocal about these things because I've actually had quite a lot of fear around talking about it.
Well, because I think it is so complex, right? It's not just about one thing. It's very complex and it's our neural pathways that are like coming back. And it's like, wait, what? Where did you come from? When the little eating disorder voice is there 10, 15 years later, triggered by a juice fast.
Right. But I think it just shows how that voice is kind of so prevalent in the culture. It's kind of, it's there all the time speaking to us, the extent to which we have all internalized it to some degree, you know, it's really scary actually. So yeah, I definitely want to ask you a bit more about that further down the line, but I'm curious, you also mentioned that eating disorders and addictions are very different. So we've looked at the similarities, but how are they also different?
Yeah. So they're very different in that I come from the philosophy and the training and the personal and professional experience, and this can be polarizing, but it's actually kind of like this newer wave that full recovery is possible in eating disorder. Full recovery is 100% possible. We can retrain our brains. We can retrain our bodies. We can retrain our behavior cycles. To abstain from food is impossible. To abstain from our bodies is impossible. So there are groups such as Overeaters Anonymous that I don't agree with, because they're actually very much, and again, I think they probably help some people, but they usually, and the research shows that it usually ends up with them still having an eating disorder after the fact, because it's putting a solution on saying, okay, we're overeating, we're emotionally eating, let's put a Band-Aid on that rather than saying why. And there's a lot of reasons why. It could be physical hunger. It could be emotional hunger. It can be a trauma response. So there's kind of like this big iceberg underneath it all. And not saying that that's not the case for addictions and substance use, but it is so incredibly complex in that we can't abstain. We can't be sober from those things.
Right. So this is where it's different, because with substance abuse and substance misuse, the quote unquote cure is to remove it and successfully not to use anymore, which may also involve a lot of inner emotional work to look at the deep roots of why have I been using this substance. But after however long, ideally, you no longer crave that substance, you no longer think about it, it's no longer likely to kind of like get the same hold on you again. But what you're sharing is that because we can't, like you say, abstain from eating, and we can't, in the world that we live in, abstain from being indoctrinated by diet culture and fat phobia. Right. It's something that we're going to have to live with and manage versus being over and done with it. Is that sort of what you mean?
Exactly. 100 beautifully said, because I always say we live in a hostile recovery environment with eating disorders. And I think a lot of people identify with that on a lot of levels with alcohol too. And alcoholism is becoming, and substance use and addiction, has become so prevalent in our language. And, you know, we do see ads and we do see things saying like, hey, here's a non-alcoholic beverage, you know, here's this, this, and this, this is what you can do instead of drinking. But we still see billboards, about cool sculpting and about diets and cleanses. And it's this hostile recovery environment where we're not even aware of the phobia surrounding bodies. With a lack of a better term, our society isn't even like woke to it yet, that fat phobia and diet culture are so pervasive, so much so in even our medical field. So it's like this hostile recovery environment where we're just constantly up against things, and we have to learn how to live with it rather than not.
There was something you said earlier about how people with eating disorders often present from the outside as being very together and being very kind of like, quote unquote, successful. Successful is perhaps the wrong word, but like in control and high achieving. And this kind of high achiever personality type can, I think, fall more easily into disordered eating too, particularly around like restriction and the binging. There's the added complication, which is that, I mean, we think about high achieving addicts, right? Someone who can successfully kind of like mask their addiction by doing well in their job or having a great family life or whatever. I think that must be very, very prevalent with eating disorders and eating disorder recovery as well.
Oh my gosh. So much so that it's like a major hindrance in intervention. When I am working with a client, and they are incredibly successful in their lives, from their point of view and from like a just societal point of view of like, they're doing great at their job and their labs look fine and medically they're fine. Or I'm putting quotations around all of this, you know, and everyone thinks they're fine and they're handling stress okay. They are like, well, I'm fine. But we really have to like really look into that and say, no, let's say you took away your eating disorder. Let's say you took away this control mechanism or numbing mechanism or whatever it might be, would you be fine? Mm-hmm. And the answer is usually the second we start recovery with those types of clients, their lives fall apart. Right. And that can be a hindrance because it's like, well, then what's the point? And then there's all this work to be done and all this emotional resilience to be gained, because then people with eating disorders who get to recovery and get recovered are like, oh my gosh, they're so successful because they have all these traits that they were using as liabilities that are now assets. And they're recovered and they're eating and they're feeding their bodies and their brain is fully functioning. It's like, oh my goodness, no wonder, you know, eating disorders are so prevalent in a lot of ways, because I think these traits go hand in hand with the disorder.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just so, so fascinating. And again, there's another sort of like correlation, but to the inverse with substance abuse, because oftentimes once someone stops using is when their life starts to like come together again. It's kind of like the flip of that, right? Although the similarity is that, well, there's still going to be all this underlying stuff that you need to look at and build resilience around and work through. 100%. Those same process, different external effect.
Yes. And I think the other piece too is there's a couple layers to the recovery process where you can be fed, but we might not be healing the behaviors. We might not be healing the emotions and thought patterns behind it. So then there's this other level of, let's say a client goes to a higher level of care, to a treatment center, and they're fed and their brain starts to function properly, but then they're feeling their feelings all of a sudden. They're not numbing them out because their brain is working. And then they're like, wait a minute, what's the point of this again? And it can take, again, a lot of skepticism. I mean, it's blind faith in a lot of ways for a lot of people, because these are people, including myself, and I wonder if you identify with this too, that's like, you need to know why you're doing something. You need proof. And so I can give people all the proof, but they need to prove it to themselves. And that's usually the biggest hurdle.
Yeah, because that can take time. Because the proof, so in my experience, again, speaking of experience, yes, is like the proof comes from living your life. And yes, the lived experience becomes then the kind of the proof that this is worth it for me, you know? But that takes time. That takes time. Yeah.
It really does. When I train professionals to be, you work with eating disorders, usually those professionals have had an eating disorder, right? I mean, it's something that they're passionate about and I think it's great. But one thing I always have to tell my trainee is there's a bell curve for eating disorder recovery. And that's 8 to 10 years and that's a long time. It really is. And in some ways that can be really, it can like be devastating to people to hear that, but it can also be really hopeful because then they're like, oh, no wonder this is still hard.
Yeah.
Right. So it's always good to know the information because it takes a long time to relearn things and then unlearn something that's so pervasive in our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You mentioned as well that perhaps alcohol, considering how widespread it is and the fact that it's legal and so socially acceptable, is also creates this kind of hostile recovery environment in that you're kind of surrounded by it all the time, and not only surrounded by it, but told that this is the way to be cool and funny and successful and popular and all those things. So there's a lot that you of resilience that's necessary to kind of like resist that. And it just, the thing that sprung into my mind as you were talking about that was like, and then a product like hard seltzer comes along, which is calorie-free alcohol. And it's like double whammy. You must have been like when, you know, the summer of White Claw, 2020 became the summer of White Claw. You must have just been like tearing your hair out.
It's a headache. It's, and then there's also now, which is even more pervasive, is like orthorexia is an eating disorder where you're, you know, really consumed by quote unquote healthy eating, clean eating, things like that, purity. And so that's another thing too, where it's like, there's these, even like alcoholic drinks, it's like, there's no sugar, there's no this, there's no that. We use like pure agave, all this stuff. And it's like this promise of purity, this promise of cleanliness. Yeah. And then also on top of that substance use, and on it, honestly, and I'm sure why we're having this conversation is there's such an overlap. I mean, so often people heal their relationship with addiction through finding an eating disorder and vice versa. So oftentimes clients will come to me with an eating disorder and they have an addiction as well. And it's like, I see a lot of people come who are like, I'm sober, I'm so proud of myself, but you know, I got there because I started this CrossFit journey and it spiraled into an obsession.
Yes. I'm nodding. I'm nodding like these big head nods as you're saying this. Yes. So one of my official questions was that I was very interested to discover, even when I was kind of like looking for someone to speak to about this and just kind of looking at the information out there, that there is a high comorbidity. And it's the first time I've heard this term, which is probably quite a generally used medical term, but a high rate of comorbidity, meaning two conditions presenting at the same time between alcohol misuse disorder and eating disorders. So perhaps could you speak a bit more to why that is? I mean, it's really, really high. I can't remember the exact statistics, but it's something like a 50% higher rate of eating disorders among people who have alcohol misuse disorder, something like that.
Absolutely. So I think there's two parts to this. And one of them is that I think when someone has an eating disorder, they have comorbidities of depression, anxiety, trauma, obsessive compulsive disorder, possibly, you know, ADHD. There's many things that they can have. So they are not eating, or they're using behaviors, which could be, again, binging, purging, overexercise, restriction. And so then when they're being social, their brain isn't on, their brain isn't working. So they use alcohol to seem like they're fully functioning. And usually if you are in an eating disorder, you can't drink that much, because even with binge eating disorder, it is rooted in restriction. So you never have enough food in your stomach. And so you're over drinking, and usually then that can lead to an addiction, a physical dependence, an emotional dependence, a behavioral dependence, and especially with specific ones. So binge eating and anything with purging can very much be associated with that. Mm. Also, there is this entire culture surrounding, you know, like, I'm going to go binge drink, so I'm not going to eat anything, because I, the calories. So then there's that piece too, and that turns into an addiction as well. And then again, I think there's this other subsect of people who are in recovery from alcohol use, and they then find quote unquote health and fitness and diet, but their traits are so obsessive with this that it becomes really disordered.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. And again, there's so much that I can relate to. I remember when I used to work in sort of magazine journalism in the UK, one of the magazines that I wrote for around this article, it was kind of like a trend piece on what they were calling drunkorexia. And it was just like, it was like a trend piece. And it wasn't particular, it wasn't kind of, it just wasn't very in depth. It was more just like, the thing to do now is to drink instead of having dinner. And people are doing it to lose weight. And it was kind of a bit, kind of a bit finger waggy, but at the same time, it was massively glamorizing it. This is the kind of era of Sex and the City.
It's also like giving people ideas.
Right.
You know, it's giving people ideas, because it's, I mean, the people reading that are usually the people that are really curious and pulled in by the headline. Yeah.
Exactly. But even coming up with a catchy term like that as well, you know, in a magazine, which is full of fashion advertising featuring a specific body type, et cetera, et cetera. It just, the toxicity of it, like, it didn't register with me at the time, because again, this is just so pervasive. We just see this. Yeah. I doubt now whether an article like that would get, would be able to be printed. We're probably talking like 15 years ago or something.
I hope that there would be a change.
I think so. I hope that there is more awareness around how the toxicity of that sort of message.
Yeah, I really hope that there is, you know, but there is still a glamorizing, I think, of eating disorders, but not so much. And I still, there is glamorizing with anorexia still, but not as pervasive as it was in the early 2000s and 1990s, but it very much is glamorized in orthorexia tendencies that, like, you know, the Goops of the world, like Goop and Poosh or all the things. And it's like, you know, we're not going to become better humans just because we're only eating organic green juice and celery juice.
So I definitely have lots of questions about that, but I want to go to a little bit later. For now, I want to talk, maybe see what your thoughts are on the kind of, there's quite a long history when you start to look at it between substance abuse and diet culture, whether it's cigarettes being sold as a slimming age. And I'm mentioning this because I'm reading a book that's set in the 1970s, and one of the characters like decides she wants to lose a bunch of weight. So she stops eating and starts smoking like 40 cigarettes a day. To, you know, slimming pills like amphetamines, which were diet pills in the 80s, like really big thing. So all of this seems to have its roots in diet culture. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, this idea that, like, you know,
thinness is better.
Thin is better, and that to successfully be able to slim means you're going to be a more successful human being. What are the roots of that? Like, where does that, what is the, going back to this thing, it's so important for me to know, like, the why do we believe these things? Like, where does that come from?
I mean, honestly, from the research and the learning that I continue to do, it's actually rooted in racist beliefs, usually. So this idea of thinness and the pursuit of thinness is a very European ideal. It really is like a white person's ideal. Now, eating disorders are pervasive throughout the entire world in all cultures. I actually did my thesis on that in my master's program. So in no way do eating disorders discriminate, because eating disorders aren't always about pursuit of thinness. They become that. But this pervasiveness in our culture, I think, is this fear of anyone that goes outside the norm of what we deem an appropriate citizen, which is usually someone who's white, thin, able-bodied, straight, Christian, pure. And if anything deviates from that and we start to see more curves and we start to see anything like that, we get scared. And it's almost like this eugenics issue. It's this fat phobia, and fat phobia and diet culture are absolutely rooted in racism. The body positive movement started with marginalized bodies and has since been co-opted, but it is very much about disability and people with, people of color and Black bodies and people in fat bodies. So I do think there's so much to be said about this obsession with thinness, but we are like being brainwashed into thinking that that's what's healthy.
I'm pausing this episode to remind you about the Sober Curious Reset, which is a workbook and self-study program designed to guide you through 100 days alcohol-free. I created it to help people apply everything that I've learned over 6 years of leading the Sober Curious movement to your life today, to help you create a sustainable shift to your drinking going forward. Now, I know that 100 days of not drinking can sound a little intimidating, but I designed it that way to give you a real taste of all the benefits of living alcohol-free. Having heard from hundreds of people who have now completed the program, I can also say with confidence that this extended, intentional break from drinking can be a game changer. Each day of content poses a different sober, curious question. This could be everything from, what do I want to make space in my life for today? To, what am I trying not to feel? Along with a specific teaching on each entry, there is also an interactive exercise for you to engage with. You can get the Sober Curious Reset wherever you buy your books. And you can also join the Sober Curious Book Facebook group to connect with thousands of others who are engaged with this work. I hope to see you there. Now back to the episode. Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And as you're talking, a few things have just been coming up that kind of seem to make sense. Yeah. If thinness very much denotes control, right? The idea of I'm in control of my desires, I'm in control of my natural urges, which then immediately to me suggests that this has its roots too in a very kind of sort of religious view that we as humans are born sinners, and that the more we can control our natural urges, particularly natural physical urges, the more godly we are. Like there's something deeply kind of about that in there, I think, as well. Yes. You know?
It's really icky.
And this is partly why, like, I guess I've shied away from having this conversation because it's mega triggering. It's mega triggering and very controversial. But then I think, as with all everything to do with addictions and behavioral disorders, like the less we talk about them, the more they just kind of live in our unconscious, making us act out in all these really dysfunctional ways. So the more we can just honestly talk about what's happening, the more chance we have of becoming resilient to all of those kind of subliminal messages that we're getting constantly that keep pushing us down the same really destructive pathways.
Beautifully said. And, you know, I think too, we forget that, you know, these disorders like eating disorders affect men. 30% of eating disorders are in men or those who identify as male. And I'm sure it's more than that, you know, because it's not talked about. But also there is, you know, this like the patriarchy. And I, again, it's some people might roll their eyes over this, but if you keep women hungry and, you know, small and always like focused on their appearance, then the men can get away with what they need to get away with. And it's true. I mean, I know under my eating disorder, I was not capable of doing the things I wanted to do because I was starving myself.
Totally. Even what you said about like, if your brain isn't getting nutrients, you literally can't think straight. You literally can't think beyond like the next hour or whatever it is. And yes, I was in a very abusive relationship the whole time I had my eating disorder and was completely controlled by this person. It's almost kind of like mythological now when I look at it. It's like just so clear what was going on. And it's so funny you said that. In my new book is called Women Without Kids. And it's kind of a real deep dive into kind of why so many women are not having kids. And I really went into it going, I'm not going to talk all about patriarchy. And I'm literally writing patriarchy about 10 times on every page. And I'm just like, I can't not use that word, which is so overused now to the point of almost being.
It's not fair because it's so overused.
Exactly. Yes. It's so overused and it's so weaponized in many ways too. But I'm like, I'm not talking about men here. True. I'm talking about this ideology that, you know, permeates throughout everything. We're all kind of under the thrall of in some ways. And I think you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Eating disorders feel very much a part of that to the extent that they're about controlling our bodies, you know?
Yes.
So one of the reasons that I wanted to have this conversation too, and again, it's something kind of controversial. I have been speaking to more people about Adderall addiction, because this is something that is, again, starting to be spoken about, recognized more and more. I had 3 friends in the past year who in their 40s have been diagnosed with ADHD and given kind of, you know, ADHD medication to help manage that. And from an interview I did for this podcast, it just seemed, I suppose I always knew that Adderall was an appetite suppressant, but it seemed to me very clear that actually for anybody who has an eating disorder, perhaps undiagnosed because it's flying under the radar, or perhaps it's not quote unquote that bad, right?
Yep.
This could be a very dangerous area because you have a highly physically addictive substance, which will also absolutely enable this disordered eating. Is that something you see in your practice frequently?
Yes, it is. That and Vyvanse. So with Adderall, that is one that can be incredibly helpful for clients who have, you know, attention deficit disorder, whatever it might be, ADHD. It can be very helpful for them in regards to just their behaviors. But when it comes to food, we have to set alarms, and they are not permitted or they're not encouraged to listen to their hunger cues because they're not accurate. So it's this education about how hunger cues are hormones and they give us signals. And when we ignore them, they stop. But if we're on something like Adderall or an appetite suppressant, we still have to feed ourselves in order for our bodies to trust us. And so that can be really confusing because it doesn't feel intuitive, but we just have to get over that piece.
Right.
Now that's hard because it feels like you're, again, going against what your body needs when you're really not. So that can get in the way. And then another thing that I'm finding gets in the way is I see, again, this is super controversial, psychiatrists or doctors who don't understand eating disorders or who have beliefs surrounding eating disorders that will prescribe those with binge eating disorder Vyvanse.
What's Vyvanse?
It is basically like Adderall. It is used for ADHD. And it's a stimulant and it's an appetite suppressant. And it's basically used to treat binge eating disorder. And that's just so incredibly problematic to me because it's like, okay, let's just like have you stop eating, where binging is a direct symptom of restriction.
Right.
So it's just missing. It's kind of like, usually the doctors that are prescribing that are also the doctors that believe that, you know, eating can be addictive. I don't believe eating can be addictive. I think we can become addicted to things we forbid ourselves from. And so that's the restriction is always the problem.
Right.
So these are the two things I'm seeing that can be really hard. And it's not like they're insurmountable, but my goodness, it can like change everything.
Yeah. Not insurmountable, but again, adds a whole other layer to what you've already described as a very complex path to recovery. So what you're saying in terms of the ADHD meds, for example, it's not about saying the meds are bad, get rid of the meds. If these meds are helping you, then it's about having the conscious awareness that, all right, so if I'm going to use these and I'm going to have them help me, then I also need to be sensible and conscious and very kind of specific about the eating piece.
100%. Yeah. In the same way in that, like, so that client might not be feeding themselves properly if they're not on meds because they're not able to really organize their day. So it's like, okay, we have to kind of weigh costs and benefits here and really have like proper medication management and then behavioral management. In the same way, honestly, from my personal experience, I in the last 4 years, I'm chronically ill and disabled and have had several neurosurgeries. That affects your hunger when you're on anesthesia and all these things. Mm. And so it's like, then I have to remind myself, even though I'm a decade into being fully recovered, it's like, no, I still have to remind myself, like, even though I'm not hungry because my body's waking up from anesthesia, I still have to eat.
Yeah.
And so I think it's this like responsibility, this extra piece we put into play.
Yeah. And I definitely want to talk about the kind of specific recovery piece a bit further down the line, because I really want to hear about, I don't know, I just already am having ideas about things I want to ask you about that. But you touched on the fact that you have a chronic condition and you are disabled. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking a lot about how ableism plays into this whole conversation too. So it strikes me that, and again, this dovetails with what we've been talking about in terms of orthorexia, this whole idea that wellness has become so tied up with a certain kind of diet, which ultimately is about a certain kind of body, whether it's like my body functioning in a certain way, my body looking a certain way, my body performing in a certain way, which seems actually, when you take a step back and look at it through the lens of diet culture and fat phobia, it seems kind of fascist. Actually.
Yes.
And so, and it really, because I've been thinking a lot around about ableism and how we have such a narrow idea about what a, not even a perfect body, but what a good body is. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit from your own experience of living with a disability to the how ableism plays into this whole thing as well.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm so passionate about this because I myself was very able-bodied up until about 4 years ago. And it's because of ableism that I didn't realize how problematic our culture is until I became disabled.
Right.
So I didn't understand the pervasiveness of this like purity culture that is incredibly fascist. You're right. Surrounding like, this is how our bodies need to function. Everything we put into our bodies has to be good. And that then is a direct correlation to our health and our wellness and our survival rates. Ton of bullshit.
Right.
It's not true.
Right. And our productivity and our value to society as well, which is where the fascist piece comes in. It's like you're going back to the eugenics piece. It's like who deserves to live?
Even? Survival of the fittest.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's this fear. I think that's what drives so much of diet culture. There's this fear of fat. There's this fear of someone being unhealthy. And there's this fear of someone being sick and disabled and lazy. And so when someone thinks of someone with disability, usually what comes to mind is someone that's lazy and not contributing to society. And it's like, well, that's incredibly false. And I realize that now because I'm disabled and I didn't understand disability and I didn't understand all of that. Again, probably because of ableism that I wasn't even really taught about these things. But now my world is just so much smaller because of my disability and chronic illness and the amount of messages I get from even doctors and family and friends and diet culture is, well, have you tried this? Well, have you tried that? This will fix you. This will fix you. Because they're uncomfortable with me being unwell. It's like this fear that if they are able to accept that I'm unwell and I have a progressive illness, that if they accept that and they accept that that isn't due to how I'm eating or my weight, then it could happen to them.
Fear of contagion. Yes. I've been doing a lot of research around this and it's just really fascinating. It's another one of those big unexamined taboos that we need to start looking at. As you're describing this, I'm also thinking one of the reasons that people fear or don't want to accept or include people with disabilities in the conversation about us as a human race is because guess what? Some people are more vulnerable and need help. And that is very, very inconvenient for us who are all climbing to get ahead and be the best and to win and compete. Like the thought of having to stop in our kind of like mission to kind of like live my best life and maybe extend a hand back, take some time out from my personal mission and maybe help somebody else because they don't have a leg or like whatever their disability might be is, it's very, very inconvenient.
It's so inconvenient. And I can say that from being tired of my disability and my internalized ableism where I'm like, gosh, this is hard. Mm. Like, oh my gosh, this is so hard. But it's also so tied to body image and that and eating disorders and disordered eating and that like, okay, well, maybe if I focus, like I'm recovered and there are times where I'm like, okay, well, maybe that it's right. Maybe if I do lose weight or maybe if I do focus on eating this way, you know, I'll feel better. Even though the research shows that I have a genetic illness that I cannot cure through taking a bath in CBD oil and drinking turmeric lattes.
Right.
But it's this idea of, and this promise that I'm going to be better and then I'm going to feel better and I'm going to be more accepted by society, you know? And I've had people who come to me with chronic illness and disability. I've had people that come to me who aren't disabled that have said, and I don't think that this is an uncommon thought. I don't think it's a shameful thought because I think it comes from the shameful culture we live in. I would rather be thin and sick than fat and sick.
Yeah.
And so there's that too, where it's like this fear of being immobile, being sick, but you've got to be thin then. And so then there's that too, where we're also keeping people who are disabled and chronically ill. Diet culture is feeding at the vulnerable people. And then we're keeping them even more suppressed because here they are not able to move their bodies, but they're also hungry now.
Right. And not feeding themselves the nourishment, the nutrients, the need to, Wow. It is so deep and so icky. I'm really happy that we're talking about it. Cause like I said before, I just think that the longer we don't, the more it just kind of continues and the deeper and more entrenched it becomes, you know, it's time to start looking at it all. So this does speak to this idea of an idea, but the prevalence, I think, of orthorexia. Is that something I remember around that time that I was kind of like reporting on the juice fast? It really seemed like it was sort of blooming and blossoming into the culture, into the consciousness then. Is it something that you've seen kind of like increase during the time that since you wrote your thesis, for example, in the time that you've been in practice? How do you see it presenting? When does it start becoming a problem? When do people start going, I need to look at this?
Yeah, well, I think that's the hard part is because it's so normalized and actually it's not even technically a diagnosis right now in the DSM, even though insurance, like it is a diagnosis, like it will be in the next DSM, the Diagnostic Statistic Manual, but it is this like overwhelming preoccupation with, again, healthy eating, clean eating, I'm putting that in quotations, purity of food. And I think it becomes a problem when it starts really affecting your life and your social life, your pillars of health. So a lot of times it will show up in people who are canceling plans, who can't go places because they don't know what the food's going to be. They go into debt because food is so expensive when it's all organic or, you know, so their social life usually is the first thing to go. And then their physical piece is really, really not great. You're not supposed to have too much of anything, but you're also like, if you're choosing an orthorexic or you have orthorexic tendencies, I should say, you're going to have nutritional deficiencies and it's really going to affect you. But I swear, like, it feels like every single new year, it gets worse and worse and worse. This reframing of Weight Watchers becoming WW. And it's like, let's focus on just healthy eating. When we start to demonize food and give food moral value, that scares me because so much of us are black and white thinkers. So of course we're going to be like, this is good, this is bad. And I just think it's going to be like, we're going to see just increasingly see like this new rise in orthorexia.
Yeah, right. Which again, very, very hard to detect, very much flies under the radar, very much celebrated by the culture at large.
So, you know?
Yeah, so, so slippery. So let's talk a bit about, let's move sort of see into sort of the cornerstones of recovery from eating disorders, regardless of, I mean, well, I was going to say regardless of how it's presenting, but actually it's probably very much about how it's presenting. Right. And like, I'm sure it's very unique and specific to each individual, but like, could you talk us through the sort of what you see as the cornerstones of recovery?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is awareness. It's so huge it's huge. You have to see, in order to get to a place of full recovery, you have to also understand that you have a problem. And that's a big piece. Usually people don't see it, again, because they're so high functioning and their labs come back normal and they're not necessarily at the weight limit and all that kind of stuff. Turns out 98% of people who have eating disorders, aren't visible to the eye. So there's this like misconception of that, right? That like you have to look a certain way, and it's actually like 98% of people with eating disorders don't meet that criteria. So there's that, the awareness piece, the intervention piece, the understanding this is a problem and I can't live with this. And then I do think a big piece, and I know this, is you have to feed yourself. So usually that's through, you know, either a group, intuitive eating, or a specialized dietitian or nutritionist, really making sure that you're getting nutrition. And then there's a therapy side, whether, you know, you're dealing with your trauma, your behavioral mood disorders, whatever it might be, that's a big piece on how you interact with the world. Usually our relationship with food is synonymous to our relationship with people. And synonymous with our relationships with our bodies. So then it's healing the relationship with people and healing the relationship with your body. The third piece I would say would be body image work. And that's the majority of the work I do with my clients, and that I'm a part of a treatment team. I used to be a therapist. Now I work as a coach where I really help people in the body image journey. They see their therapist work and they work on the mood disorders or whatever it might be. They're making sure they get fed. And then another piece is peer support. I mean, advocacy, awareness, the amount of clients I have who have found recovery through doing advocacy, speaking at walks, you know, writing a blog, starting an Instagram page, being a part of a group, it gives them purpose. It turns their problem into their purpose. So I would say that those are some of the biggest factors. Now, if you have an eating disorder that needs medical intervention, you know, then you also need like probably inpatient hospitalization.
Right. Yeah. And somebody like you, or ideally like some kind of person's medical professional is going to be able to help diagnose whether that's the case. Yeah. So what you're describing actually are very similar to what I might think of as, you know, the tools of recovery for any sort of addiction, actually. Awareness, actually admitting I have a problem, acknowledging, okay, I can't actually continue the infamous, like, you know, I am powerless against this substance, this behavior, whatever it is, it's controlling me. I'm no longer controlling it. And then looking at the kind of underlying emotional issues, which, like you say, are so often tied into our relationships with other people and then our relationship with self as well. I'm really curious to hear a bit more about the specifics of the body image work. That's what, when I said earlier, I was like, some things are firing for me. It just seems like so much of it is possibly about really learning to accept, and not only accept, but to love and appreciate my body, like as it is, for what it is, how it looks, like for how it feels, you know? So can you talk a bit about the work that you do with people around body image?
Yeah. I mean, so much of our relationship with our body is our attachment style with others, our attachment style with food, and our attachment style with ourselves. Could be anxious, avoidant, codependent. And we have to look at that first, usually, that attachment style and how it's affecting our relationship with our body. Usually it's quite avoidant. Usually it's quite controlling. Oftentimes clients will dissociate from their bodies completely. And so a big piece is figuring that out, and then figuring out how can we become in, how can we practice embodiment? How can we practice being in our bodies and exposing ourselves to that without having a stress response, and with coping with that stress response? And so that is a lot of somatic work, breath work, mindfulness, meditation, self-care, coping. And then we do a lot of neural retraining and the unlearnings of our internalized fat phobia. And that's usually the most uncomfortable work to do, because it's admitting that you have these beliefs. But it's so important. We all have them, because we grew up in a fat phobic society, right, and we're still living in it. And so it plays a huge part in the work that I do. But I usually I help my clients get to a place of body acceptance and body neutrality rather than body love. Mm-hmm. For instance, and I love body acceptance because I was healthy, able-bodied. And then all of a sudden, you know, like I almost lost my sight completely. And, you know, now have mobility aids and whatnot. And I had to learn how to accept that my body will continue to change, and accept that that's just how it's going to look, rather than love a part of my body. And then what if that changes?
That makes sense. The acceptance piece being with whatever is presenting, yes, just being with it, being okay with it. It's so fascinating what you said about attachment styles. I'm particularly interested because I helped one of my book editing clients write a book about attachment theory last year. So I've got really kind of into the concept. Could you perhaps in your own words just explain like what attachment, I mean, it's a hugely deep subject, but perhaps just a very brief overview, because it really, as you said it, immediately I had, oh, I'm avoidant.
Right.
Of course, like I avoid food. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. And the avoidance coming from,
yes,
this kind of coping mechanism of, well, I don't need nourishment, actually. I'm fine, mm-hmm, because I'm, yep, self-sufficient.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, so there's different attachment styles. The one we would strive for would be secure attachment style, where we have just like a really nice secure attachment with someone, where we feel okay if they leave, we feel okay if we're by ourselves, communication is clear. We feel that our stress response, you know, our amygdala doesn't go off. We feel at ease, safe, secure. And then there's a really common one, which is anxious attachment style, avoidant attachment style, then an anxious avoidant attachment style. And usually that is going to be someone with an eating disorder, where it's, you know, this push and pull, this feeling of not feeling safe, or this complete avoidance and saying like, I'm just not going to deal with it. I'm just not going to deal with it. Mm. I'm not going to deal with this person. I'm just going to flee. Mm. And usually that is quite synonymous with like our stress response to like fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And usually that will tell me what someone's attachment style is, mm, with their body. Mm. So we have fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And oftentimes I'll see that in someone's relationship with their body. Let's say they somatically, like physically feel something in their body, like maybe their pants are too tight or they feel bloated. It, depending on what their stress response is to that, I can tell, okay, I think your attachment style is XYZ. So if their stress response to that is to just ignore and restrict, that is flight. So that would be avoidance. Mm. Now, if they do that and then they purge, that would be fight. So that would be anxious.
Right.
And so there's different ways in which we can look at that.
Yeah.
Secure would be, I'm feeling bloated. Okay. I'm going to go and have a glass of water and take a deep breath and move on with my day.
Right. Right. To not make that responsible for your well-being and for your sense of safety and for your sense of being in control and being held. It is such a fascinating subject. And it goes back to, yeah, our early relationship with our the wiring that happens in our nervous system, in our relationship with our earliest caregivers, which is just another, I don't know, for me, that's a really interesting, yeah, thing to start to look at. And I know Marianne Woodman, who's a Jungian psychologist, who's written a lot about eating disorder recovery, talks a lot about the relationship with mother in relation to our relationship, mm-hmm, to food, which again is like a whole other subject, but a little, yeah, seed that if people are interested, yeah, they can sort of take and do some more research around. Just to finish up today, I'd love to, if you could tell me a bit about your AND initiative. I just read a little bit on your website about that, and I really love the concept. So yeah, share a little bit about that and how that plays into or is a part of your work.
Yeah. So it's the AND Initiative is something I started not too long ago. It launched in December of 2021. And I realized when I became chronically ill, that it's really easy to fall within the parameters of your illness or diagnosis or identity. That becomes it, right? And I wasn't ready to accept that it had to be just one thing. As I started to talk about this more and more with people, I realized how much it resonated with people, with mothers, with people with mental illness, addiction, chronic illness, disability, that we can be this and that. And it's one of those philosophies I used within my work too. You can feel two emotions. And I've always said, you can feel and emotions. You can be sad and hopeful. You can be, you know, happy and angry. And so the AND Initiative is two things. One, a social movement in which we can share how we live, and we can share that I am disabled and thriving. I am sick and CEO. It's the other part is that it's actually a foundation. We have a fund. You can apply to us through the andinitiative@gmail.com and send in an application and say, hey, I am disabled and this is how I want to live my AND life. And this is what I would need. And then we would, by application basis, gift people their wish lists. So the first thing we did was we gifted a rollator, which is a mobility aid that was actually like covered in Swarovski crystals. It's a company out in Denmark called Biacre. They're amazing. And they actually, like, their Outlander rollator is so freaking cool. They actually collabed with Range Rover. And so it's like very sleek. I name my rollators. I have Pearl and Petra. They're fabulous. But anyways, we gifted someone a rollator in December, and we'll be doing that again at the end of the first quarter. So an example of what an AND could be would be, for instance, I have my mobility service dog. I have my rollator that allows me to live my AND life. For someone, that could be, again, a rollator. It could be a couple sessions of therapy. It could be a spa day and a babysitter and some diapers, you know, allowing yourself to live and not be stuck in these parameters. And I realized that might not be so accessible to people. So that's why we started the AND Initiative Fund. You can donate through the fund. You can go to our collabs with OXB, which is a fine jewelry company out in Denver, female owned, or you can buy our merch.
Amazing. Well, I'll include the links for all of that in the show notes for this episode. Jane, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. I'm so happy I found you. I think you're doing amazing work.
You too. Thanks.
That was my conversation with Jane Mattingly. I could have asked her many more questions, as this subject is so wide-ranging and nuanced. If this episode resonated with you, please do share it with a friend. And remember to rate and subscribe wherever you listen to help more people find the show. As always, the Sober Curious podcast is edited and features original music by Aloe Audio. Find them at aloeaudio.com.